I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. If you love listening to this show as much as I love hosting it, I think you'll really like the Medal of Honor podcast, produced in partnership with the Medal of Honor Museum. Each episode talks about a genuine American hero and the actions that led to their receiving our nation's highest award for valor. They're just a few minutes each, so if you're looking for a show to fill time between these Warriors episodes, I think you'll love the Medal of Honor podcast. Search for the Medal of Honor podcast wherever you get your shows. Thanks. I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. In partnership with The Honor Project, we've brought this podcast back at a time when our nation needs these stories more than ever. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for listening, and by doing so, honoring those who have served. Today, we'll be hearing from Colonel Gail S. Halverson. Known far and wide as the Candy Bomber, Halverson earned his title for dropping handmade parachutes filled with gum and sweet treats for the children of Berlin during the Soviet blockade.
Well, I just come back from a trip to South America. I was relaxing in a swimming pool at Brooklyn Air Force Base in Mobile with some of my buddies and having a good time. And I was feeling especially happy because I'm almost being bald-headed then. I needed all the help I could to get a date. And I was able to get a brand new four-door red Chevrolet. And I was able to get this from a dealer down in the islands. And he couldn't sell them down there, and after the war, they're hard to get in the States, and I was able to buy one. So I was pretty proud. I was in a glow. Peace was at hand. The war was over. Good time at the swimming pool. And then we got a call from Colonel Cassidy to say, hey, we got a rush pilot meeting. Everybody over there in an hour. And that's how I first heard that blockade of Berlin is occurring, that Stalin was cutting off all supply routes, that they'd already been flying some supplies into Berlin and C-47s and need bigger airplanes. They said, we want 4 years as fast as you can get them. So it was a surprise. Well, yeah, so we thought, you know, things are going to be okay now. We did in the back of our mind and had heard and read about Stalin and his aggressiveness pushing westward. And it was a little concern, but here we faced reality. Now it looks like, man, here we're going. We're going to leave our comfortable places here and stake out in West Germany and start flying night and day, 24 hours a day. Sound like a little bit of the same old theme that we'd been used to before. We're hoping there weren't going to be any shooting, but we already heard that a Yak fighter buzzing a British transport plane and just earlier in April had misjudged his closing rate of speed, and both airplanes were crashed and everybody was killed. So we didn't know whether the guy was going to, if we were going to overtly support Berlin against Stalin's desire to starve those 2.5 million people. We didn't know what those Yaks would do. And we'd heard the fighter fields were beneath the three air quarters in Berlin, and they were loaded with fighter airplanes. And of course, we knew they had ammunition. So there was a concern in the back of our mind. But my girlfriend wasn't being too friendly. She was out west in Utah, and I was in Alabama, and my handwriting's not too good, and she didn't know that I really cared about her. So her letters weren't too friendly, so I just will go on the airlift, as far as my love life was concerned at that time. So I volunteered to go. A buddy of mine, Pete Soa, was supposed to go. He had a new set of twins coming back from Panama. I volunteered to get him off the list and put me on, because he would feed us Sunday dinner, me and another bachelor. And his wife certainly didn't want him to go to Germany. And that's how I got started to go. A little concerned in the back of my mind, but he thought it'd be pretty interesting. There were thoughts about helping the Germans, former enemies, who were trying to destroy each other, trying to kill each other. And now they're asking us to fly night and day to give them food. And Colonel Cassidy explained to us a bit what the political situation was. The Soviet Union was pushing toward the West, looking to take over control of satellite countries. Berlin was an island in the Red Sea, the focal point, inside their territory. And that was the focus of the Soviet drive. They wanted to get rid of that island of democracy, that island of free enterprise, of capitalism behind the Iron Curtain, because they couldn't convince the 300,000 soldiers around Berlin their system was the best when they could go to West Berlin and see the change was occurring. And he explained that to us and said, hey, this is where we draw the line. If we don't draw the line, we don't know how far west Stalin will go. He wants Berlin, the people there, women and children. He's trying to starve them. And that's all it took. Everybody says, hey, let's go. We left on the 10th of July. We got there on the 11th of July, 1948, to begin our operations into Berlin. When we first got our orders, they said, oh, this won't be very long. We just got to go for a little while until the politicians get their act together, and nobody's going to stand the world for Stalin starving the people. You get a black eye. It's going to be over pretty quick. Don't worry about it. So we had our summer flying stuff. We weren't very well equipped, and I took my red Chevy four-door that was really the apple of my eye, and didn't have time to do anything with it. Drove it up under the pine trees outside the bachelor officer's quarters, locked it up and took the keys with me and thought, well, I'll be back pretty quick. So really, we didn't think, I don't believe anybody thought this thing was going to go on too long. Our last leg going into Rhein-Main from the States was leaving the Azores, Brest, France, and then into Frankfurt. And we knew there was chaos long before we got to Frankfurt. We could see the airport tuning in the frequencies for control. It was just disaster. We tried to call two or three times, couldn't even get in. And so we were prepared for the worst as far as traffic congestion, of control problems that were involved. With that, we came into the airport. It was pretty visual. We had to make a letdown, but we had a good seating underneath. There seemed to be airplanes everywhere on the approach, lined up to take off. Large numbers of aircraft lined up to take off at the takeoff end. Some are still engines running. They changed that procedure later. But it was airplanes all over the field, interspersed with large semi-trailers in wherever the space where they could fit them. So it was a really interesting mosaic that greeted us when we arrived at Frankfurt, Rhein-Main. Well, an arrival after flying, we didn't stop except for gas and something to eat. And we had three crews on my airplane, and we just kept coming. But we thought, boy, we're going to get a real reception here. Here we are, pilots with a lot of experience. They're going to be glad to see us. And boy, the guy acted like that we'd had 24 hours in the sack, and who's going first? And so the freshest crew, John Kelly, in our group was the first one to go. And he said, hey, we'll be ready to go to Berlin about an hour and a half. And so the rest of us wondered where we're going to sleep. And we thought, well, they'll have a nice place for us, you know. Well, all of normal barracks were loaded. They were filled. There was no place in the inn. And they said, okay, you got two choices. We got some tents that are set up, or we got a displaced persons camp across the Autobahn, where we've got these displaced people from all over the world that Hitler's pulled out of their countries and been doing probably slave labor, and they're in some tar paper shacks. You want the tents or the shacks? So we said, well, we'll take the tar paper shacks. We'd have enough tents. So we went over across the Autobahn to Zeppelinheim, and they were just moving these displaced people out of the tar paper shacks, and trucks loading up their belongings. There's nothing in the shacks except a black pot-bellied stove. And that was the scene. So, hey, guys, we got a job to do. Fit yourself into the schedule and hope you get some sleep, and we'll have a mess hall set up for you near where you're sleeping soon. So that was the situation. We very well, very quickly decided, hey, man, we're not that important. The important thing is to get the stuff to Berlin. That's the mission. We soon got the importance of food in this whole equation. That's what it was all about, Operation Vittles. And one of the cases was there was some flour spilled on the ramp from a bag. And already they would take the little pieces of coal and sweep them into place. And in this case, the coal was mixed with flour. And this person carried a bag with him. A lot of them carried a little bag with them in case of such emergency, and would scrape that into a bag and worry about separating it later. And this occurred a number of times. Just the coal in little pieces they'd save to carry away in their pocket. It was just amazing. I didn't see anybody stealing stuff, but stuff that was on the ground or spilled, if they could get it before somebody else did, why, they'd take it. The other kind of thing that impressed me a great deal was in Rhein-Main in Frankfurt, a midnight mess. We were coming in from a flight, three round trips, and eating. And when it was over, we'd take our dishes out and clean off anything that was left, and then put the dishes in another barrel to be washed. And as we left, started to leave, I could see somebody come out of the shadows and go in the barrel. We'd scrape some of the food and pull it back out and scrape it out in a plastic bag to take back to a child or a wife. There were German workers who were there, but we coming straight from the States, we didn't clean up our plate all the time. You know, many times we did. But then we learned to do that because how important that food was. Coming into Berlin, the first time, fortunately, the weather was pretty good. We get a visual look at the city and laid out, but I wasn't prepared for what I saw. I'd heard about Cologne, I'd heard about Canterbury in England, and of course seen the devastation in London from the bombing, but I wasn't prepared for what I saw in Berlin. It looked like a moonscape. The walls of the buildings were up. You could see right straight through them. No windows, of course. Only one building in five was partially usable. It was just desolation. And I said, 2.5 million people? How in the world could they live in a place like this? So the first thing was a shock. How can people live in this place? And of course, the same thing was in Russia, in Leningrad. It was destroyed the same way. And the impact of what war had done sunk in and says, wow, if these guys are here, they need food, all right. And it just verified the understanding we had that this is important to be here. Now, the quarters of Serberlin, there were three, the southern, center, and north. All of them were 20 statute miles wide. Of course, Stalin wasn't kind enough to give us a radio fix in the middle there to navigate. He just told us, guys, you get out of the quarter and you're going down. We're going to force you down. And over east to Germany on the southern route, I can't remember for sure, it's about 120 miles without any navigational aid. But leaving West Germany into the corridor, we had an ILS leg, a very precise navigational aid that would let us kill the drift. By the time we got out of range of that leg into the corridor, we'd pretty well have our drift set, unless we had a very strong crosswind that varied before we got in range of the low-frequency Homer in Berlin. Now, when we were there, early July, we didn't have any radar operational in Berlin when I first started getting into Berlin. We had GCA on and off, but not very long. This wasn't totally functional. We didn't have any long-range radar. So we'd kill our drift going into the corridor toward Berlin and then pick up a Homer. We had a Homer, low-frequency Homer, and also a radio range in Berlin. And we'd hope to stay within the corridor until we picked that up. So, well, I didn't have any qualms about it. I was a little bit concerned. The night flying and thunderstorms at night were a problem because the low freak is not very good. The ILS leg coming in was okay. But then from there on in, before we got the radar, besides the thunderstorm activity interfering with the Homer and the radio compass, the Russians set up an alternate site on the same Homer frequency. And I missed it totally one night through thunderstorm activities, went partway into almost to Poland. It's only 30, 40 miles. And finally got turned around and came back in. That's the night I lost the engine. So things were pretty hectic for that night. But we didn't have a lot of qualms about that. we knew the fighters weren't going to give us much trouble in a thunderstorm. So we knew that if we got out of the quarter in the bad weather at night, that we weren't going to get intercepted because they didn't have the all-weather capability that we had and were used to using in most cases. I'm sure in some of their Air Force areas that they had people who were highly qualified in weather, but these fighters were mostly day visual fighters or clear weather night. The aircraft were harassed in the quarter. The British had a tougher time maybe than we did because Gatow on the British sector is right on the border practically, at the east, and they would position spotlights, could blind them as they were coming around the pattern, and they had spotlights focusing in their eyes. They had ground exercises, ground firing. You could see tracers at night and this sort of thing, and they were supposed to keep it on the ground or very near the ground. So that was, there were aircraft exercises in the quarter. But the most common, and there were some balloons with some cables here and there if you weren't in the right spot, but the ones that I experienced most was the buzzing of the Yak-3s. Our quarter went right over the airfields, and they were loaded with fighter airplanes. And they'd come up head-on, not all the time, but often enough to keep you awake, come head-on and peel off the last minute. And again, I remembered that the Yak-3 had done that with a British transport in April and before we got there, and they both crashed and killed everybody. So I was hoping their depth perception was all right and on target. And the first time we went in the quarter, we were looking for these guys to see if they're going to shoot at us because we're still early in the airlift. And the precedent hadn't, in our minds, hadn't been set yet about what the protocol was of our aircraft accessing Berlin. But after we'd been buzzed a number of times, come up behind us, come up over, even over our wing and come down the other side, when they didn't shoot, we found out why. President Truman had put 60 B-29s on the runways, and England had said, come on, bring them on. And he told Stalin, hey, you know what that capability is, a B-29. And you know what we got. Keep your hands off those transports. And after a while, when we got comfortable with these Yak, except for their depth perception, well, we enjoyed seeing them buzz around and break the monotony because it was just hours of boredom flying through there. And if the guy came by, it was kind of fun to see him buzz you. Well, flying the quarter into Berlin, we were right over the Yak-3 fighter airfield, the Soviet Union. They had a lot of them, and they'd come up into the quarter. They weren't supposed to be in the quarter. They come in the quarter and come head on to you. You'd see that old guy in that fighter coming right to your windscreen, and the last minute he'd just pull on up and peel off and disappear. And we just hoped that he could see well enough and gauge it well enough that he's going to miss us. But we'd be on the controls anyway to watch, track him, determine if he's a little above us or a little below us. And the last minute, if he wasn't going to duck, we're either going to push it down or pull it up. So we were prepared for that. And a lot of my buddies, it'd be fun to talk about it. But we were concerned whether or not this guy was good enough to miss us. I know that one particular night in the middle of winter when it was, we had snow and even gusts popping us around. And I was able to get on a secondary frequency and just tell them, hey guys, you saved your life again. Because they're real pros. They didn't get enough credit after the airlift, I don't believe, the important part that they played in making the airlift work. I remember Jake Schuffert's, I've always laughed at Jake Schuffert's cartoon. Here is the Radio Shack. Of course, the Radio Shack's out in the mid between the runways, out in the field, and they want to make sure the guys are landing on the runways, not in the shack. But here's this crew with all they got is a control yoke in their hand and smoke coming out all over them, and they're knocking on the GCA door, and he said, would you repeat that last transmission? I thought that was great. But these guys were so good that they need all the credit in the world. The weather in Berlin in November particularly, and low visibility, was very bad, and it stopped us. There were some periods of time, hours and so forth, that we couldn't deliver the goods in Berlin. We couldn't because of the weather and severe either icing or extremely low ceilings that would be dangerous. And by this time, we're putting a lot of tons into Berlin. We're building up a little reserve. We're doing better than the 4,500 tons a day required. So Tunner says, hey, we're not going to kill anybody doing this thing. We got to be reasonable. But there were times when we couldn't deliver to Berlin. But, you know, we didn't wait till the weather was okay in Berlin to take off at Rhein-Main. We'd take off anyway. Berlin's closed, 0-0. We'd take off out of Rhein-Main for Berlin. You know, you got an hour and 45 minutes. And the hope is that as soon as you can see enough to land, that there's an airplane in 3 minutes from that time, 3 to 5 minutes from that time, that thing opens so you can land. There'll be an airplane on the final approach. If you wait till it's clear enough to land, come, it's 2 hours before you deliver anything. And so I really like that. I really like going for the positive, saying, hey, by the time I get there, it might be open. And only once when I took off and it wasn't, it was well below minimums, I didn't even take a chance. Just poured the coal to it when it got down a little bit below minimums and took it back. When we first got to Rhein-Main and started flying to Berlin, it was critical to get as much tonnage there as soon as possible. We didn't have enough aircraft available, enough crews available, and so we're flying three round trips a day. Now, three round trips, I mean, 24 hours, it might be night and half a day. That would take, three round trips would take about 17 hours. And by the time you unloaded, loaded, and got around the horn, traffic control, and the rest, and then you'd have 6 hours of sleep, if you're lucky, at first, to do it again. And when we got more crews later on, more aircraft, it was two round trips a day out of Rhein-Main or Wiesbaden, and it was two round trips more than it was three round trips, just the first one was tough. So those were the times. Now, the people in the north had a shorter distance in the British zone, Fosburgh and Sully, and we had half of our C-54s up there. And a lot of people forget to honor Fosburgh and Sully for what they did. Now, they could fly three round trips easier than we could because we had a lot longer. And two airplanes in Fosburgh could fly as many tons into Berlin as three airplanes in Rhein-Main because the difference in length of the two corridors.
The Battle of Waterloo was one of the most famous turning points in world history. But what happened next? My name's David Montgomery, and I'm the host of The Siecle, a history podcast that tackles exactly that. Join me as I cover France's overlooked century in between Napoleon and World War I. The Siecle, spelled S-I-E-C-L-E, is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network and can be found wherever you get podcasts.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
When I first got to Rhein-Main, I thought the airlift would be over right away. And when I saw Berlin from the air, the desolation, I'd heard in history class about the Brandenburg Gate and the Reichstag, and of course, Hitler's bunker. Everybody knew about that. And I wanted to see it. And of course, landing at Tempelhof, you couldn't leave the airplane. let alone go around town sightseeing. And so one day, I got through my round trips about noon in July, about 17th of July. And my buddy Bill Christian was flying, getting an airplane ready to go right back to Berlin with a load of dried potatoes. And I thought, crumb, instead of going to bed, it's a beautiful day, I better get to Berlin or this thing will be over and I'll never see Berlin. And so I grabbed my movie camera, hoping I had it with me most of the time, and told my co-pilot, John Pickering. I said, John, get to bed, and Herschel Elkins, my engineer, because I'm going back to Berlin and get some pictures, and I'll be back before we have to start flying again. So go to bed. I jumped on an airplane with Bill and headed to Berlin. I had a buddy there in traffic control who had a Jeep and said, I'll take you, see the driver, chase you all over Berlin, get your pictures. Before I did, I wanted to get a picture of the airplanes coming over the bombed out apartment houses because of a bad approach. And I wanted to get some movies of those. And so I went around the inside of the barbed wire temple off the opposite end of the field from the terminal before I went to the sightseeing to get the landing pictures. And inside the barbed wire here, bombed out buildings here, a grass place in between. I was shooting the airplanes. Right behind me was the runway, standing right there, the picture coming over it. All of a sudden, I noticed across the barbed wire about 30 kids, 8 to 14 years old, right up against the barbed wire, looking at me in the uniform that was bombing them 3 years before. I was wondering, hey, they're going to be friendly or throw rocks at me? But the boy, they were friendly. They were saying, hey, how many sacks of flour you got in this airplane? And they were keeping notes on how often airplanes were landing. He said, we've noticed the last 2 weeks there are more airplanes coming. He said, that's great. And then the little blue-eyed girl was translating. She said, hey, look, the weather's not going to be this good all the time. If this thing's still going on in the wintertime, it's going to be really tough. And that was the thing that really hit me. She says, look, you don't have to give us enough to eat in those times. Don't worry about that. Just don't give up on us. Just give us a little. Someday we'll have enough to eat. But if we lose our freedom, we may never get it back. And those kids were teaching me about freedom, and America is supposed to know a new depth that I did really start to realize what it meant to these Berliners. They saw what Hitler did, destroying the country. Their dads and moms were killed, half of them. And they knew what Stalin was like. He was right across that artificial border. No wall. They could come back and forth. Their aunts and uncles would come over to get in the library to see what was really going on in the world because Stalin wouldn't put in their library what was happening. And they told them what it's like. If you go to another town, you got to register the police. Even if it's 30 miles away, you got to register the police. They can't say what they couldn't elect who's going to direct. Well, these kids really were fantastic. And I looked at my watch. I'd been there too long. I said, hey, I got to run. I got to go. I got a Jeep waiting for it. Took off. Started to run. And a little voice came to me and said, hey, these kids are different. How come? Wow, they got a postgraduate degree in international relations. They're not out of elementary school yet. They know what value is. That freedom's more important than thin rations. That something's more important than food. That principle to be free. And those kids know it now. I said, boy, that's fantastic. And then I took off the Jeep. Little voice says, hey, that's good, but that's not the answer. And then it bothered me so much. I was worried about the Jeep so much. And this little voice brought me. I stopped and said, how come? And then it came to me very quickly. I'd flown to South America, Africa, and many countries during the war and after the war. You walk down the street in American uniform, kids like that in those groups, even though they had some gum, can't even chase you, grab you, shake you by the arm. Say, want some gum? Give me some chocolate. But of those 30 kids, not one of them would lower themselves to be a beggar. They hadn't had gum and candy for months, none. And looking at me, American, they'd know I must have something. But not one would even hold out their hands, let alone say anything. They were so grateful to have food to be free that they wouldn't be beggars for something so extravagant as chocolate. Or gum. And it just blew my mind how mature they were. I reached my pocket, just broke out in a sweat. I hope I've got something. I reached my pocket and all I had was two sticks of gum. About two sticks of gum, 30 kids, you'll have bloody noses. That stuff's like gold. But I said, I'll never see him again. I better give him what I got. So I broke it in two, passed it through the barbed wire. Boy, the kids just went bananas. The ones that got it looked like they got $1,000, and the kids that didn't get any were real disappointed. Crowded in. I thought, here comes a fight. But they didn't. They were asking for something. And it was obvious they wanted a piece of the wrapper. And the kids that got half a stick carefully tore off the outer wrapper, tore off the tin foil, and handed it to them. And they smelled it. And their eyes got big, and they remembered what it was like when they had gum. And it just blew my mind. Coming out of the States, all we needed, and to see what a piece of the wrapper on a half a stick of gum meant to a kid right then. They held it in their hand, put it in their pocket or kept it in their hand like it was a precious jewel. Well, I thought, for 30 cents, I can give them a whole stick and the wrapper and everything. But I didn't know when I'd be flying 24 hours out of sleep. I don't know when I can deliver it or when I'll see these kids again. About that time, an airplane came over the bombed out buildings right over my head and landed behind me. And I got a flash that says, hey, if I airmail it, I deliver it tomorrow, and I won't have to lose any sleep. And so I said to the kids, I was a little worried because I didn't have permission. And you know, if you're going to push things out of airplanes, you got to have permission. But I rationalized quickly and said, this whole airlift's not according to oil anyway. Starving people, what's dropping a little parachute? So I said, look, kids, come back tomorrow. If you share it, I'll drop enough gum for all of you to have some, if you'll share. So yavol, we share. He's jumping up and down. I started leaving. He called me back. We got to know what airplane you are. Every few minutes, there's an airplane landing. We got to watch for the airplane. I said, a wiggle of wings, the big 54, when I come over the beacon at the airfield. When you see that, get ready. That's got it. I said, hey, get out of here. Let's start this thing. We couldn't buy much gum and candy. It's ration. So I went to when I got back to Rhine Mine a few hours before I had to take off again, I asked them for their ration. And they wanted to know why. And I said, this is what I'm going to do. And they said, you're going to get in trouble. And I said, I'll be responsible. Give me your ration. So they did. And we had a big double handful. And even had chocolate bars. And boy, it was heavy. And it smelled, boy, I just smelled that thing and thought, what did that do to those kids? And then I thought, wow, hit them in the head with that. Going 110 miles an hour, make the wrong impression. I thought, how am I going to do this? And then I remembered the old handkerchief in the rock trick. Tied three handkerchiefs, broke it up in three pieces, slow it down so the kids could see it. And so if they lost one, they wouldn't lose it all. Went back the next day. First time was still dark. Next time, just forenoon, clear. Looked down there. There's those 30 kids right in that open place between the bombed out building and the barbed wire fence right there. They hadn't told another soul. Wiggled the wings of the airplane and they just went crazy. Came over the bombed out building. Their arms were up. Their faces were up. And right behind the pilot seat is a flare chute where emergency flares can be pushed out of the airplane emergency. And the Sergeant Elkin standing between the pilots is right there. And I says, you push it out when I tell you. And just as we crossed them, I hadn't pushed it out the flare chute. I was worried that the pilots lined up to take off would see it and report me, get my tail number. Or we'd drag it across the barbed wire on the runway. But as they unload the 20,000 pounds of flour in about 15 minutes, taxied out to take off along the barbed wire, there was those three handkerchiefs through the barbed wire, waving at all the airplanes. And all their mouths were going like this. I said, wish they wouldn't do that. And old Pickering says to me, he says, hey, those kids know who you are? And I says, no, I didn't have my name tag on. I was non-standard that day. And I had my hat on. They didn't know I was bald. They didn't know who I am. And he says, good. We won't tell anybody. The kids were out there every day waving that week. And we thought, there's a few more kids. Do it again. Do it again. Did it again. Bigger crowd. Did it again. Three times we did it. And then the weather was terrible in West Germany. I went in base operations to find out what the weatherman didn't come around the airplane. So Ford and Lloyd ran in there to see huge stack of mail on the big planning table, looked at it. It said, the letter said, to Uncle Wiggly Wings, Tempelhof, base operations. To Schokoladenflieger, Tempelhof, base operations. Boy, I broke out in sweat, ran back out there and says, we're in trouble. There's a post office full of mail in there for us. And so we quit. We said, no more. We would get in trouble. For 2 weeks, we quit. And then we looked at each other. We saved our ration, said, once more, and that's all. So we came back with six parachutes on a flight. Beautiful day, wiggle the wings, went crazy down there, dropped it, and said, that's it. And that's how it got started. We said we were going to quit after our last big drop of six parachutes. The next day, coming back from Berlin to Rhine Main, an officer met the airplane. He came on the airplane and he said, who's flying this airplane? My buddy's pointing at me. He said, he is. Why? And he says, Colonel Hahn wants to see you right now. And I knew Colonel Hahn and he was a great guy. But I went in to see Colonel Hahn. He says, Halverson, what have you been doing? And I said, flying like mad, sir. And he said, I'm not stupid. He says, what else have you been doing? And for about 15 minutes, I thought I was going to go home early or get a court martial. And then he reached under the counter, pulled out a German newspaper, threw it on the counter in front of me. And there was my airplane with parachutes coming out of it. He said, you almost hit a German newspaper man in the head with a candy bar in Berlin yesterday. He's got this story all over the world. He said, the general called me this morning to ask me about this operation. I didn't know anything about it. Why didn't you tell me? And he said, I said, I didn't think you'd approve it. He said, you're right. I wouldn't approve it. He said, the general thinks it's a good idea. You can keep doing it, but keep me informed. Well, I breathed a big sigh of relief that I wasn't court-martialed. And so then my buddies gave me theirs. They heard about it, and I'd come back, and there'd be a case of bars from two or three guys pulling their rations. You know, Wrigley's double mint gum was a favorite, and they give me their old handkerchiefs, take shirt sleeves for candy bags and shirt tails for parachutes. We ran out of stuff, and we went to Berlin, of course, immediately, and gathered up all the mail and had two German secretaries to read it and answer the letters we couldn't. And the kids in Berlin heard we out of parachutes, so they sent back the old ones for refills. And then not only that, some that didn't catch any would make their own. One little boy, Peter Zimmerman, he wrote me and says, look, he says, I'm 9 years old, but my legs aren't as long as normal kids 9 years old. I can't run very fast, and I'm not getting any of this stuff. He said, I almost got it today, but a bigger kid beat me to it. And he says, I saw the parachute, made me a beautiful parachute, the strings the right length, and a map. He said, when you take off, after you unload your flower, come down the canal to the second bridge, turn right one block. I live in the bombed out house in the corner. I'll be in the backyard every day at 2 o'clock. Drop it there. Well, I had a lot of these special requests. And the tower would let me in good weather, stay down low and fit me in later and make drops. So I couldn't hit Peter Zimmerman. I kept missing him. I sure was following this good map. Finally, he wrote me a letter and said, look, he said, you're a pilot. I gave you a map. How did you guys win the war anyway? Well, we got to be good friends with Peter. I took a big bag and package of gum and candy to Berlin and mailed it to him in the mail. You could mail it in the city. Couldn't mail it across to East Germany, the city, and mail it. And he wrote some other good letters, and he needed some shoes. His dad and mom were killed during the bombing of Berlin, and he's living with an uncle. And he needs some boots, and so we got him boots and sent him the boots in the mail. He didn't try and drop those, of course. And he finally became a candidate for adoption, and a family in Palm, Pennsylvania adopted Peter. Oh, another letter, as an example, of a little girl wrote me. Her name was Mercedes, and she says, you're causing us a terrible problem. We live right near the airfield, Tempelhof, and we've got a bunch of white chickens, and they're not laying eggs anymore. You come right over our place, and they think you're chicken hawks, and they quit. They're losing their feathers. Well, for an old farm kid from Garland, Utah, when my buddies on Saturday would go fishing, I'd be cleaning out the white chicken coop. So I understood the chicken problem. The last paragraph from Mercedes was the payoff. She says, when you see the white chickens, drop it there. I don't care if it scares them. Well, I couldn't find them. I drop it all over the approach, and by that time, 22 schools in Chicopee, Massachusetts had an old abandoned fire station, and they had an assembly line, and they were sending over 800 pounds of stuff in big cardboard boxes every other day, candy bars and Wrigley spearmint gum and other gum manufacturers gum, and parachutes ready to drop. We just cut the top, and my buddies were dropping all over the city, the squadron dropping all over the city, over radio fixes, churchyards, playgrounds, everywhere. Too big a crowd near the airfield. So we dropped all over the city. So I said, guys, concentrate on the approach to hit Mercedes. We didn't hit Mercedes either. So I took a big package of gum and candy to Berlin and mailed it to Mercedes in November 1948. So those are a couple of letters, thousands and thousands of letters that we received from kids in Berlin. Not too long after the airlift started, of course, it was getting a lot of press all over the world. And people in New York wanted somebody to come back and tell them what it was like personally. And because of my experience with the dropping the candy bars, General Tunner called me in and said, hey, they want somebody to go back to New York and Washington and tell a firsthand account of how it's going. This was in September 48, so it hadn't been going that long. And so he asked me. Then I remember as I left his office, he yelled at me, he said, "Halverson, don't get the big head." And I said, "I won't. I'm bald-headed. I'm pretty humble." And he said, "Okay." So we came back to the States, brought back an airplane that was going to be overhauled anyway, and came back to New York. And the main program was We the People, one of the early well-known national television programs, We the People, and then many other appearances. And then I got a call from the president of the American Confectioners Association. So I'd like to take you to dinner at the Manhattan Hotel. I want to talk to you about something. So I worked the schedule, went with him. There were four forks with a plate. This, from a farm kid, I learned, wow, this is really fancy. I wonder what he wants. Well, anyway, he said, look, he asked me a few questions about the operation of Little Vittles. He said, "How much of this stuff can you use?" And I just thought, how many guys in the squadron, and gave him some ridiculous number, and he started to send it. Well, Swerzy was a Heiler Candy Company executive, and he knew the president of the American Confectioners Association. He was one of the first to say, "Hey, we'll supply whatever you need." And all of the candy manufacturers and gum manufacturers started to send this stuff to Chicopee, Massachusetts, to be assembled by the school kids there. They sent 15 documented tons of candy through Chicopee, and part of it was sent over by ship, and 6,500 pounds of candy bars was sent over by ship and rail to Rhine Mine in December 1948, 2 weeks before Christmas. And by that time, we were dropping plenty. We took that 100 pounds at a time into Berlin. I had a jailhouse that was partly empty, and I put that 6,500 pounds in. Day before Christmas, we had a Christmas party over Free Berlin. And the East Berlin kids were still writing. He says, "Hey, don't drop it over here. We're still getting some, but we'd like to be blockaded too if this is what it's going to be like." So those East Berlin kids were great. We got thousands of letters from kids that received package of gum or candy from the air. And the kids in East Berlin were no different. They liked it even more than the West Berlin kids, because they had it, didn't have it quite as tough right then because they had enough food in East Berlin. But they wrote me letters and said, "Look, hope you're not mad at us. We're East Berlin kids. We can't help it where they put the border." Said, "We'd like the Americans. And we're coming over to West Berlin and we're catching some of these things that you mean to drop to the Free West Berlin kids. But hope you're not angry because, oh, this is so good for us." And said, "But it'd be better even if when you come over East Berlin to land, you come over East Berlin to make your approach, drop it there. There's not so many people. And we'd really like that." And I said, "Why not?" So I did. I started dropping over East Berlin. Almost every approach, not every approach, but frequently would drop over East Berlin. Came back from Berlin one day to Rhine Mine, and there was an officer to meet the airplane. He said, "Halverson, what are you doing over East Berlin?" I said, "I'm dropping to those nasty communist kids." And he says, "You can't do that." It was Lieutenant Colonel Gilbert, who had known from Mobile. And I said, "Why not? The law of gravity is the same on both sides of the border." And he excused me for being impertinent. "So that's not the problem," he said. "Problem is that the Russians, the Soviets, have gone to the State Department and complained. It's a capitalist maneuver. It's a capitalist trick to influence the minds of the young people in their sector against them. And you can't do that. You've got to stop. It's airspace that's questionable. We get in real trouble with using the airspace. You got to stop." Well, I've met people, kids that were in Berlin at that time, grown up, that have come out since and told me what it was like. One lady had escaped during the wall. She and her husband both got out and were city planners in West Berlin. And when they went back to West Berlin one of the times, after the wall was up, it happened to be the same function. And she says, "Hey, who are you?" And I says, well, I gave her my name. She says, "Why did you quit dropping in East Berlin?" And I was surprised. And she says, "I was a little gal and I caught 13 parachutes in East Berlin. And then you quit." And I had to tell her. But they'd escaped and they were city planners in West Berlin. I guess they're still there. Some of the letters were from all areas of the city, and especially the hospitals. course, this was a time period when the polio epidemic, they'd had a polio epidemic in Germany, and they had at least two hospitals, big hospitals, with several hundred kids in them with polio. And one day I got a whole package of mail from the kids in the hospital. It had been collected by Mr. Mason, who was a American public health official, whose job it was to visit these hospitals and prioritize their needs from x-ray film, the kind of thing that they needed to help support the hospitals. And when he left the hospital, both hospitals, one day the kids gave him a big package of letters for me. And every one of them were thanking me for what we're doing, but in a very mild way, saying, we can't walk. We can't get out and catch this stuff. We can hear the airplanes. But the doctors have promised us that they won't report you if you fly low over the hospital, and they'll go down and get the stuff. Well, the hospitals were located in a real tough place. It was a non-standard place for traffic control that I just couldn't work. So I thought, about that time, I got a big box full of bubble gum and a bunch of Hershey bars. And I thought, man, I'll just take this stuff. I'll have enough time between flights. And that time we weren't flying as fast, often as we were before. And so I loaded up enough, I knew how many kids there were, and took all this bubble gum and candy bars to the hospitals. And Mr. Mason met me, took me around. I couldn't blow the bubbles very well, so he demonstrated these kids. Well, the time they gave them a candy bar each and bubble gum. And that was one of the most rewarding experiences I've had in the airlift, is to see these young kids and the appreciation in their eyes in the hospital situation for something so radical as a fresh candy bar, fresh chocolate from the United States of America, when they had none, had none at all, and were on dried eggs and dried potatoes. And we did fly a lot of fresh milk for the youngest kids on the airlift. But it was a wonderful experience to be with those kids in the hospital. The people, the Berliners, were so grateful. The gratitude, it just get them so emotional they couldn't talk. They just, tears would come in their eyes. They come out to the airfields. They come out the ramps. The little kids would bring flowers. The people would bring flowers. And in the middle of the winter, I don't know where they'd get them, but they'd bring things to show their appreciation. And it was just overwhelming, the letters that they send, but in person, what they do. One little girl came with her mother at Tempelhof. She didn't know that I was a candy bomber. I just stand there by the airplane. And she came over. They'd have escorts. And her mother, both of them spoke a little English. And her mother says she has something that she wants to give you. It was normal that they would come to present something. She had a little teddy bear, and she handed it to me. And it was not a new one. The elbows were worn. And she says, I want you to have this. This is my teddy bear. She says, it was with me in the bomb shelters during the war when you were dropping bombs. And it was with me in the final battle when the Russians and the Soviets overran Berlin. I was in the cellar, my teddy bear. And it's a good luck charm. And it'll bring you and your fellow flyers good luck. I could see how much it meant to her. And I said, hey, you keep it. It'll be good luck for us. Keep it. It's probably the only possession that she still had left. But she had tears in her eyes, but she says, no, you must take it. And I knew then that for her to be happy about her gift, that I would take it graciously. I flew with it in the cockpit, and it was there that day that it came head on. Maybe the teddy bear was the reason that we didn't have a head-on collision. I don't know. But that's a symptom of how deep the feeling was from the people in Berlin. And those who were there then, that same feeling comes back. I was in Berlin a week ago in a meeting, and an older person stood up with tears in his eyes, told the people there how much it meant to him. He said, my parents would not have survived if it hadn't been for the airlift, and I wouldn't be here. That gratitude was the thing that caused us to fly day and night, and the people on the ground to work day and night without complaint, because it was for something that was appreciated. They wanted freedom more than enough to eat. And that knowledge made our problem flying day and night very small. Looking back at the airlift and wondering what the influence was, I'm sure that the post-war history would be different if it hadn't been for the airlift. That Berlin was the final point of where we draw the line, that you're not going, the Soviet influence was not going to go beyond or absorb Berlin. Some people wonder, say, well, what significance was this thing of little parachutes and candy? That's insignificant. And it was in itself. But to me, as I recall and hear from the kids that grown up, it was a symbol of something from outside of this blockaded, this city under siege, that somebody knew they were there from somewhere else. They'd walk to school in the fog or in the clouds, and out of the cloud would come a parachute and land at their feet, and the letter would come. It was telling them that somebody was aware of what their problems were in a city under siege, and that they cared for them. There was an external connection outside of this wall of steel and tanks that surrounded the city. And it gave them a feeling of self-assurance, of hope. And hope was the most important thing that a person can have in personal trouble in life, that somewhere there's hope for a better future. And I think that part was a contributor to that. But the big airlift, the humanitarian effort in behalf of a former enemy, was one of the greatest influences in bringing people together after a great war, a terrible tragedy. Working together again accelerated this process, brought the German people and the American, British, and French together quickly. It galvanized their working as a team, and it changed post-war history. Without the airlift, the way it was carried out in the humanitarian way, post-war history would be very different today than it was then. In 1994, they had an exhibit, an international exhibit hall at Frankfurt Rhein Main, and a lot of it was on the airlift. They had parachutes, candy bars hanging from the ceiling, and I went there for that event to open up this exhibit. And at the time, we were supporting Bosnia. The refugees were pushed out of their homes or in the mountains and the foothills and in the snow and trying to survive and live away from their residence. And it recalled to me the situation in Berlin during the blockade of Berlin. I went to the Air Force there and asked, I'd like to fly one of these missions. I'd like to be with this modern crew in a modern airplane and make drops. They were dropping the food supplies. Of course, some were landing at Sarajevo. But at this time, when I was there, it was the fire, ground fire, and this thing where it was a real problem. And so they were dropping from the air, C-130s, mainly from the American effort. And so I was able, through the grace of the people at Rhein Main, to be outfitted. I still had an ID card, of course, I retired, able to fly in the airplanes. And we made up a bunch of candy bars and parachutes, just like old days. And we had about 20,000 pounds of food and blankets to drop in the mountains. And so we had a six-ship formation to Bosnia from Rhein Main. And it really brought back old memories. A lot more sophisticated with the radar, because we were going to make a night drop of 16,000 feet with all the lights out and just the radar man bringing us in over the mountains, over this village 30 miles from Sarajevo. And we had the package of little parachutes and candy bars tied to the back of the last pallet that was going out the back of that C-130. And when we opened those doors and pushed it out, we had a lanyard on it. And out they went, and this lanyard opened up the box and little parachutes came out. I don't know how many they found, but I'm sure they found some. There were thousands of refugees in the mountains waiting for those blankets and food. And I hope a little surprise package, a candy bar on the end of a parachute, like it was for the kids in Berlin that found a child somewhere in Bosnia without a home, without enough to eat. In my view, the heroes of the airlift were civilian or military. The civilians were the Berliners. They slept in bombed-out buildings without enough heat, without lights except for a few hours very early in the morning, and without enough food. They said, we'll never give up. We don't care if we don't have enough to eat, like the children of the fence. We won't give up. And they didn't. And without that determination and that commitment, the airlift wouldn't have worked. The military heroes were not the pilots, in my view. The military heroes were the aircraft mechanics. Without them keeping these airplanes flyable, we wouldn't be going anywhere as pilots. You taxi out to takeoff at Rhein-Main in the middle of wintertime and the snow blowing horizontal. And these aircraft mechanics were out there in the open field, sometimes with a canvas and a wooden frame to cover them. There wasn't room in the hangars. They were full too. But they had to work out in the open field. And they were doing that, in I'm sure, at Fosburg and Celle and Wiesbaden, fingers freezing to the head bolts. And those guys kept the airplanes running. Of course, the security police and the cooks and everybody else had a part. But to my mind, the dedication of those aircraft mechanics were the real heroes. The single military guy, of course, was General Tunner. Without him, it would have been disaster. He was a genius at airlift and planning airlift. And General Clay, without him, he was on the spot to begin with, long before Tunner got there. He knew what had to be done. He was the real hero, military hero of the post-war era, and bringing on board the determination of the coalition of British, French, and Americans to support whatever it took, the determination to stand Berlin. So General Lucius Clay was one in a million. He was, when I said military, he was a military man and an ambassador and a great servant of our country and the cause of freedom. Of all, he has to be the preeminent person in my view.
That was Colonel Gail S. Halverson. Thanks for listening to Warriors in Their Own Words. If you have any feedback, please email the team at kharbaugh@evergreenpodcasts.com. We're always looking to improve the show. For updates and more, follow us on Twitter at @team_Harbaugh. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review. Warriors in Their Own Words is a production of Evergreen Podcasts in partnership with the Honor Project. Our producer is Declan Roars. Bridget Coyne is our production director, and Sean Ruhlhoffman is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Evergreen executive producers Joan Andrews, Michael DeAloia, and David Moss. I'm Ken Harbaugh, and this is Warriors in Their Own Words.
History is the greatest adventure story. But does it ever leave you wondering what the women were doing all that time? This is Lori from the Her Half of History podcast, and the answer is that some women were seizing power, or escaping slavery, or spying for their country, or creating artistic masterpieces, while countless others were doing the laundry, getting married, and wondering why their clothes don't have more pockets. If you would like to hear the stories of women doing all of those things, check out Her Half of History at herhalfofhistory.com or wherever you get your podcasts.